Mars, our planetary neighbor, the only planet where humans can go and live. We have reached the moon, but will humans ever reach Mars? And why should we go there? To search for life, or to do geological research, or just because it is there? There are other questions as well. We live in an era when human beings of planet Earth may be able to go to Mars. This is the first time in the more than 3 billion years of terrestrial evolution that any beings can leave the planet. Only humans can make it. And who knows what the future holds for us. Tomorrow we may not be able to make it. Civilizations come and go. Maybe tomorrow another intelligent species will come and colonize the solar system. We can't know. But what's sure, we can try it now. Then, why do we wait? In this program, we take you to the place where we have tried to make the first steps towards Mars. Very small steps, which may lead to the next giant leap in the future of mankind.
My name is John Itema, and I've been slotted as the commander of Crew 42 here at the Mars Desert Research Station.
My name is Catherine Bywaters. My job here is the crew biochemist. I am taking soil and rock samples looking for halophiles, which are salt-loving extremophiles.
I'm known as Creamer. Okay, I'm the obvious. I've taken care of the plants that we have growing here.
My name is Dennis Hands, here at Mars Desert Research Station. My official job is crew astronomer, and I'm helping Ben, our chief engineer, get the telescope and the observatory up and running.
My name is Ben Hissett, and I'm part of the Crew 42, and I'm currently serving as crew engineer, which means it's my job to make sure that everything works properly.
And I am Henry Clarkitai, mission geographer of Crew 42 at MDRS. Mars Society's Mars Desert Research Station is one of the most important terrestrial Mars analog stations, where its crews simulate life and work on Mars. The volunteer crews change every 2 weeks. Scientists and engineers devoted to the human exploration of Mars. The habitat, or HAB, can only be left in spacesuits. In January 2006, we made more than 10 EVAs, or fieldworks, extravehicular activities, exploring the badland areas of Utah, which provided a real Martian environment, maybe except for the blue sky. But not to get too far ahead. After nearly 6 hours of traveling by car, it was dark when we finally arrived at the station, far from all inhabited lands. When we arrived, the previous crew welcomed us.
Hello!
Hello!
Welcome to Mars.
Mission Welcome Aboard.
And you are?
John.
Hi John, nice to meet you.
Janet.
Hi Ben.
Oh
my God! I've seen you again! Welcome to Mars!
I'm so happy to have you at Mars!
Hi Henrik, nice to meet you.
Hi Dennis, how are you?
Good. Hi.
Oh, I'm the other Dennis.
Oh, there's two. Oh, yeah, Dennis. There's a Dennis Hand and another Dennis.
Thank you.
Hi,
Dennis.
Hi, I'm Henry.
Hi, I'm Henry.
Nice to meet you, Dennis.
Come on, pull up some chairs.
Hello.
Hi, Maggie Zubin.
Let me move the boas. Still.
Boas.
Hi, Dennis.
Later, they officially gave control of the station to us for the next 2 weeks.
Okay, so I'd like to do the official changeover from crew 41 to crew 42. first the key to the castle. This is actually the key to the drug box.
Yes.
But, you know,
yeah. Oh, right.
So you and your ace also have one. Some crews wear those around their necks. I was just hanging in my room, and that's where it is. And this season we have instituted the changing of the guard with the commanderly scepter. And no, we have not used it in the bathroom.
No, there's another one.
There's another one downstairs.
It's a pure and pristine scepter.
Yes. So I now pass the scepter to you.
Reality of simulation really depended on us.
I think the stricter we're probably as strict as we need to be, and like okay. when things get spotty and squelchy, or when it's really busy, you know, we should probably there's a certain behavior, and then you know ultimately, you know, we've been on Mars for, depending on the simulation, maybe we just got here, maybe we've been here for 6 months or something. Also,
we've trained together for the last 2 years. We spent the last year getting here. We know each other quite well.
Right. Okay. So a lot of that is, I'm sure, very allowed.
And it was also our decision when to start the simulation.
Okay, are we all in sim? Everybody put your hand in. And we are in sim!
Okay. I had my last cigarette. And wait till the crabbiness comes on.
153.00 Mountain Time.
1353. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
From this moment on, everything changed. Earth was left far away. But a new, bright blue star appeared in the sky. This was the Earth, with the moon next to it. Gravity decreased to one-third. The horizon line came 1.5 kilometers closer. The solar energy was reduced by half. The airlock, where we entered, now separated us from a world where pressure is 6 millibars instead of the 1,000 millibars of Earth, and the atmosphere became mainly carbon dioxide. It was not possible to breathe or live outside, where dust was a major problem that had to be kept out of the HAB. The freezing temperature, however, during the daytime was realistic, but during the night it was 80 degrees Celsius below zero. There was no question, we could only exit the HAB in spacesuits. We were alone, isolated in a vertical white cylinder, which was our home now. It was connected to the observatory, the generator, the green HAB, and the garage through a system of pressurized tunnels. In our imagination, at least.
I guarantee you.
Before starting work, we got detailed health and safety instructions.
Okay.
Safety training.
Sure. Please feel free to, please do refer to the pages that are attached. Page 1 is called Safety Training Sheets for MDRS Crew, and then I've written in the number 42 up there. On the first page is the outline for the training that I'm supposed to go over this morning. The second page has emergency contacts. Here are telephone numbers and descriptions about the different people that we might need to contact in case of an emergency. Page 3 is a description, introduction of me as your health and safety officer, and our flight surgeon will be Tam, C-Z-A-R-N-I-K. The flight surgeon, Tam's a doctor, And so if we have a medical emergency here that we cannot handle, that if it's a minor problem and we can handle it, that's fine. But if it's a major problem and I'm feeling overwhelmed, or the commander thinks that we need to, we'll contact the flight surgeon. We've already done that once as part of our pre-sim work. And we know how to do that, and he knows how to contact us and stuff like that. And then he can give us permission to open a box. John and I both have keys to this box that has prescription drugs if we need to. And he can give us, the flight surgeon can give us permission to open that box and dispense prescription drugs if we need to. Also, if there's a problem, we might need to break sim there if a major problem. And then emergency reasons, time is more important than protocol for emergency reasons. So there are transport options at the bottom of the page. So just a brief description for minor problems, major problems, and super major problems. Okay, questions, problems, concerns? Then page 4, fire hazards. A big problem with fire hazards. The closest fire department is a half hour away, so things will burn down. The fire problems would be the stove, the hot plate, any stove and hot items downstairs. Those are very dangerous, and so we need to be very careful with those. So we need to know where the fire extinguishers are. On the lower deck, there's one that we need to all check when we go downstairs. Here on the upper deck, there's one just to the right of the sink. There's a fire extinguisher hanging about eye level, and then there's another one over here by the steps.
There's two on this floor?
Yes. Yeah. Ben knows a lot more about the operation of the ladders than I do, so I asked Ben if he would say a few words about these two egresses from upstairs.
Okay.
Ben,
Hood,
please.
If for some reason someone starts a fire right there, and you can't get down the stairs, and in your opinion, running through the flames, even for a brief second, is not the thing to do. We do have two other options. However, they do contain a moderate amount of a risk. But it is better to get a broken limb than have the next station named after you as you film, like, a Morton station. Okay, plan A. If you can get out...
Crew 42 Memorial Habitat.
Yeah. This, you simply pull and release, and you undo the four clamps holding the window in. Thing is burning, just hurl the window away, just push it out.
Right. It won't matter.
It won't matter. Down below, we have the rope ladder. Hang it over the window, kick it out, let it come down. This particular thing is reinforced. Climb out, go down. B is, if they have a really bad day, the blast will go that way. Hopefully not too much falling through.
Okay.
That's,
yeah. Good point. That. Well, Ben, thank you very much. Good job. See, great guest speaker, huh? That's what a good teacher does, right? He's a good guest speaker.
That's right.
Thank you, Ben.
Absolutely.
Our crew engineer, a veteran Marsonaut, could repair everything that went wrong, and he could even make the four webcams work at MDRS.
My name is Ben Hussett. In real life, I am a computer systems analyst. I make sure the computers play well with each other, computer networking, stuff like that. And I'm part of the Crew 42, and I'm currently serving as crew engineer, which means it's my job to make sure that everything works properly. Things from plumbing and heating, electrical power, plus whatever the scientists require for their instrumentation. And someone needs to make sure that the place keeps working. You know, hopefully the people who initially built it did a good job and things don't break too often, but things will break. And that's one of the things humans are really good at, is identifying the problem and fixing it. When I came out on Crew 34, I re-established the webcams. There had been webcams here before, but when that crew went, they took their webcams with them. And so I brought out a webcam as part of 34, and I left it here. And it's been running pretty much continuously whenever there's been a crew here ever since. They have added some more webcams to the system, but those weren't working properly. So currently at the moment, we've got four webcams running right now, two servicing upstairs, one servicing downstairs, and one looking down on the hab from the observatory.
Why do you think the webcam is so important?
It allows people not here who have loved ones here or just interested in the project just sort of to vicariously participate in the mission.
After leaving the MDRS station, are you going to have other jobs related to Mars or planetary science?
I hope so, but I'm not expecting it. I do a lot of outreach for my local chapter of the Mars Society. Myself and Hugh Gregory, who's the MDRS historian, we are appearing at a science fiction convention in Minneapolis, Minnesota area. First weekend of March, and we'll be talking about this, and we'll have a display table at the convention running all weekend. So we're doing outreach, stuff like that, and I've got another one scheduled in July in the Twin Cities. So I anticipate doing that sort of thing, as well as being active in my local chapter there. Just at the beginning of the Mars exploration rover Spirit and Opportunity, we built a life-sized rover out of plywood and plumbing parts. One thing that everybody seems to like and is extremely simple is what we call our gravity bottles, in which we've got 3 1-gallon bleach bottles, one filled with water, one third filled with water and styrofoam packing peanuts, and one sixth filled with styrofoam and water. And we say, well, if you're doing a laundry on the moon, you know, it's the bleach is quite light and stuff like that. So, and people seem to enjoy that.
We made a detailed timetable, which included personal chores for each day.
So today, Dennis, you are responsible for planning and executing the evening group meal.
Woohoo, pancakes!
Kathy, you are second floor cleaning. Heinrich, you're first floor. And Heinrich, you've also pulled the first shower today. So I don't, you know, I mean, I think let's apply the schedule. Take your shower. Take your all showers are Navy showers. You get wet, you get sudsed up and clean, and then you get rinsed and you're done.
One of the most important tasks was to maintain the green hab or greenhouse. This is the place where fresh vegetables grow and where grey water gets recycled. The surroundings outside are lifeless. The only green plants are at the round windows of the hab. So if someone wanted a little time for relaxation in a green area, the greenhouse could be the place for it. The green hab was maintained by our crew biologist.
I'm Dennis Creamer, a retired biologist. I'm 72 and I do a lot of recycling. I sometimes do volunteer work for the Forest Service and National Park Service and also Fish and Wildlife Service. And I find things to do. I belong to a Star Trek club. Or at the MDRS, I've taken care of the plants that we have growing here. They have various bush peas and beets and a lot of lettuce, a lot of different lettuces. Hopefully someone's going to eat them, make a salad out of them. They need to wash them first because I sprayed them with nicotine solution to retard aphids. Besides, it's restful to come out and be able to see some green growing things out here. Well, these were planted by, brought in, as seedlings by the last crew. Mm-hmm. So since the beginning, less than a month, and they're up like this. Here we have spinach, and the ones back this way are beets. The ones with the red stems are beets. Yeah, the other crew made some salads from the lettuce. I'll show you what's in here before I start watering the other crew. This is the smelly part, but these are the trickling filters. See that the effluent first comes in here, recircles back and forth. There's bioballs up there, what they call bioballs. They're coated with microbes. They help to break down the materials that are in the wastewater that's coming out. See, all the sink water and all of the shower water flows in the system. Eventually, it comes in the first tank here, and here you see some water hyacinths that are supposed to help take up the nutrients from the materials. A few more in here. They're pretty poor. They don't look too good. This is duckweed, and it doesn't look that great either. They just keep overflowing here. And the last tank over, that's the toilet supply tank. TST. From here it goes directly up to this, and then it runs up to the tank, fills the tank up, and of course the tank flushes. But but this supplies the water to the toilet. Now, from the toilet, it goes out to a septic tank. We've called that black water, you know, the toilet, that's black water. Shower water and, you know, sink water, that's gray water, we call it. Well, that's essentially it.
One of the most important parts of the simulation was the closed spacesuit. Putting on and connecting the pressurized helmet was not easy. Every kind of connectors, cords, had to find their places.
You see it okay?
Yep.
And testing the radio was also essential.
T-18, this is Habcom. Do you all copy? Over.
This is Geoman. I copy you.
Try again, Geoman.
This is Geoman. I copy you.
Okay, very good. So remember, with the helmets, you hold the button down and then speak. Don't speak and hold the button down simultaneously.
It was not easy to use the push and talk buttons in gloves. And hopefully, no one forgot. Yes, the toilet. Another mission essential, since all suits were closed. Now, if everyone is ready, we can enter the airlock. After 5 minutes of decompression spent in the airlock, we can exit for the surface.
You are go for exo.
Away team, you are ready to leave the airlock.
Exo. Okay, this is EVA Commander, we are leaving the head.
There could be cold outside, however, we could not feel it in the warmth of the suit. Worse, of course, when the helmet gets wet inside and visibility is reduced. This is a perfect time for the sweat to pour into someone's eyes, which, of course, cannot be reached through the helmet. Depending on the distance of our target, we could walk or use the ATVs, all-terrain vehicles, or if we had to go further, we could use our PEV, or pressurized excursion vehicles, which is also called pressurized rover, or for short, BLUE. Naming places was another part of the mission, and the naming process can be easy and fast.
It's a neat little plateau. Should be the name for it. Neat little plateau.
In other times, it took a little while to find the perfect names for some features.
Hey, what do we name them?
Well, there appear to be at least six prominent peaks, and then a bunch of others. Can think of anything with six?
So this range here...
That's right, Zubrin. Anything around here named for him?
No.
It almost looks like a... like a half-submerged hippopotamus or a turtle or something, or like a pod of turtles, like half buried in the water.
Turtle Hills? What do you think? Turtle Hills?
That's good.
Say no.
Okay then, what about the other one, a little bit further to the right?
Turtle Hills?
Yeah?
And unnamed.
It sort of looks like a serpent or something in and out of the water, like that.
Dragon or the Loch Ness?
Yeah, that's good. It's also got that white band in it.
Yeah.
On the right-hand side. It's got that white band of rock there.
Like a racing stripe, like it's a racing stripe range.
What about band dragon or striped dragon?
Banded Dragon Hills, I like it.
And for the next one over, that's sort of close to Phobos, but not as tall.
This one. This is a long range. It goes down to the road where this Bob's Rock Garden is. It's got two higher hilltops, like a camel.
Like two camels, called the Kissing Camel Range.
That's good, that's very good.
Oh, that's so romantic. We've got Kissing Camel Range that goes from the right over, right toward Phobos.
Yeah.
We've got Flat Top just on this side of the end of Kissing Camel. And then we have Banded Dragon, which is the one closest here with the white band in it.
And the one which is left from Phobos, that is the Big Daddy Point, or part of it is the Big Daddy Point.
To the left? Yeah, that's Big Daddy Point right there. To the north of the Kendo Chasm.
Mm-hmm.
With Goose Gulch in it. What's that, Heinrich? The baby banded dragon? Whenever I see all those gentle curves and mellow radiuses, it reminds me of a bunch of ladies laying on a beach. That's your name for this series of low hills right here.
Yeah.
Look like dunes are beach to me, Miami Beach. I like it.
What about lady dunes?
Sunbather dunes or sunbather hills or hills that look like women's parks. Butte over there. No. Never mind.
Woman parts?
Geomorphological parts, of course. You wanted to call it that? You got the map. You're the boss. What was your suggestion, Heinrich?
Mine was Lady Dunes, but I will just write down what you say.
I like Lady Dunes too.
On our way back to the Hab, it can be really fun to identify features we have just named an hour ago.
The Pimple! Mount Rushmore!
Uh-huh.
The Lady Dunes!
True, some names were really weird. From time to time, apart from hills shaped like dragons, we have found signs of life, sometimes only as tracks, other times extremophiles or other strangely shaped objects.
What do you think that little dune is? Is that some kind of anthill or some kind of animal hole? What do you think? I bet it's an anthill. Somebody explained to me that this pebble is the largest sized material that they can move, and the smallest size material that the wind won't take away. So all the smaller stuff gets blown away, and all the bigger stuff stays in the ground. So what you end up with is just net pile of just this kind of material.
At other places, fossils could be found, which may also lie in the dust of Mars.
Mark this down as a fossil bed. Almost possible.
Mm-hmm. And there were times when we actually saw the animals.
The real, that was a jackrabbit.
He had some tall ears. He was tall.
Goes into the shadows. Let's go kill that rabbit and eat it. Violate the vegetarian thing?
We were all vegetarians because of a food study testing on us, so we let the rabbit go. It wasn't very Martian anyway. On our way, it is recommended to check where we really are.
Here we go, Heinrich. Here are the numbers. You ready? 0517583. Second number, 4248715.
I will make a checkpoint. I will write down the coordinates, so I'm in 2 minutes.
So we're basically 052, just a little bit on.
Okay.
That's
gotcha.
052.
Gotcha.
Got it. 424-6887. Here's 424-425. So we're at 4246. So we're a little more than halfway. So if it was 4245, we'd be exactly between 424 and 425. But we're at 4246. We're a little bit above that. And
we're right by the river.
We're right by the river, right on the road. And we're just up the road from here. And this is where we turn in to go to the half.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Okay. I can do that.
Is that clear?
That's clear. Roger Wilco, 555.
So that's it. We're looking for this position, which is basically the same northwest coordinate. So we're gonna stay at 4246. What we're looking for is 0501.
Okay.
0501.
Hey, left check right up here. Hey, when you want me to stop?
Okay, then give me a coordinate.
Right here, here you go, Heinrich. 051763.
And we may be lost, even with a GPS unit, on the hilly terrain.
On the map.
Sometimes the terrain is barely passable, and if we run into a deep wash, we hope that we can get out.
Actually, this doesn't look that bad from here.
We want to just go now?
Sometimes we are wrong. The next task, then, is to toll. In this case, we were outside the radio range. We could not ask for help. We were on our own, on Mars. We could only trust ourselves.
Can you try reverse? Reverse?
Got some rope?
Virginia, Blue Ridge Mountains, Shenandoah River. Life is old there, older than the trees, younger than the mountains, growing like a breeze. Country roads.
I'm over it with yours.
It just doesn't start. I found a good place where you can cross this valley here, where I am.
Most important, above all science, is safety. Accidents may happen during EVAs. The result is that we break SIM. If someone's air stops coming, this is a reason to break SIM, at least for him or her.
Go. You mean it doesn't work?
So you two go?
But since when?
I just noticed.
Okay.
Could you repeat that?
I tried to call Habcom.
Okay. Habcom, this is Geoman. Can you hear me?
Not copy.
I copy you. We are at the Skyline Rim.
Skyline Ridge. I copy.
Okay.
To let you know, you officially killed your girl. My pack wasn't charged, and I ran out of air. They killed their only girl.
I'm responsible for the EVA room, so it's my fault, actually. But all the lamps were green, so they all were charging, and they were all full this morning.
Of course, in such a situation, it is the same whoever's fault it was. Later, we worked out a method to connect two suits. This way, one can give his or her air or electricity to someone else. We have successfully tried to solve such an emergency situation. But by then, at least in SIM, we have lost Kathy.
It's a god-awful small affair to the girl with the mousy hair. But her mummy is yelling no, and her daddy has told her to go. But her friend is nowhere to be seen. Now she walks through her sunken dream to the seat with the clearest view, and she's hooked to the silver screen. But the film is a sad thing for she's lived it 10 times or more. She could spit in the eyes of fools if they ask her to focus on sailors fighting in the dance hall. Take a look at the low man, beating up the wrong guy. Oh man, wonder if you'll ever know who's in the best-selling show. Is there life on Mars?
In all our EVAs, we set a communication fail-safe time. If the EVA team has not returned or called back by this time, a rescue team is deployed. Most of the time, radio connection was impossible, so we had to return by the daily deadline.
No signal at this time, no signal.
And anyway, we were not prepared for night EVA.
Upcom, this is EVA 5, do you copy? Upcom, call back. Right tonight, Upcom.
One EVA could last for 4 to 5 hours, so it was a very happy moment to return to the HAB, take off the helmet, and breathe normally.
HABCOM, this is EVA team, we're entering the airlock.
Not yet, HABCOM, we're entering right now.
We are locked down, HABCOM.
Roger that, studying 1 minute recompress.
Got so foggy I started to get claustrophobic and freak out.
After returning, we started to enter and process our field data. And in the afternoon, before, during or after dinner, we discussed what we learned on that day and planned the next day's mission.
Okay, so the after action review, well, first the mission essential task item, we sampled our communications system, we sampled our, I think the interesting thing is it was a team effort to suit up.
It seems like, well, here's, so what Heinrich and I will do is we're going to plot out our points that we traveled on. And we really lost you in a real hurry, actually. I think we were right here. We were just behind a hill. We were next to the Schiaparelli Highway. We were just behind a hill. And, yeah, we had nothing. And I came out on the other side of this hill.
Oh, you guys were going this way.
Well, we kind of tooled around.
Crested a hill at 328.
Right.
Had real good communication. Way too much static at 322.
Right. I had everything dummy corded, and so I did not lose anything. But I didn't. I'm wondering if it'd be a good idea to just duct tape one of these hogs right on your finger.
What you usually do is you duct tape the cap onto your arm, and then you just take it out right with it, and then
I like
put
that.
It back into
That's
your
a good
arm.
Idea. I had the helmet that I had didn't have any diverters on my air tubes.
Yeah,
it was shooting right into my ears the whole time.
I had them on both sides, so I was very happy about that.
So what we'll do is we'll pull all the helmets. We'll pull all the helmets and make sure that. We'll do a helmet maintenance tonight, and part of our helmet maintenance needs to be a comm check with all the helmet radios. Right? We didn't do this. Because
there's one that's not, you can't hear on.
Right. Let's sort it out. Let's sort it out in the market.
And the diverters, what other problems did you run into with the helmets that maybe we need to look at? Anything else?
No
other problems with helmets.
Helmet was good, I think. Okay. For me, the gear was good. The helmet was good. I thought
soap on the inside.
I mean, it was a little janky towards the end there, and we climbed a couple big hills. We were really trying to truck around. Okay. When we found that reservoir, we climbed the top and we were walking on this ridge.
Okay.
I think I would like. I haven't been out yet, but I think I'd like to keep my hammer and tools on like a basket in the ATV. Just because I'll have to use so many different things, and it'll be really heavy.
How can you fix the basket?
I think we can bungee cord some baskets.
You can tie wrap and you tie wrap it to the little.
So then next time we should
a metal frame.
Yeah. Okay, let's do.
And I mean, I'm going to have a lot of samples to carry back, and if there was something with a lid of some sort.
Our crew biochemist.
My name is Catherine Bywaters. I'm a student at MiraCosta College. I'm an undergraduate. My job here is the crew biochemist. I am taking soil and rock samples looking for halophiles, which are salt-loving extremophiles. What I do is I take the rock samples and I put them in an LB, which is like a nutrient broth, and I add salts, a saline solution to that because I want to kill everything else and keep only what grows in extreme salty conditions. Then I take and I plate that, and I look at the plates to see which specific halophiles I have. And I'll be taking the plates back to San Diego with me so that I can run DNA or RNA tests on them and find out which ones I specifically have. Okay, I have several different varieties here because not only do they come in different colors, I have a cream, a yellow, and a pink different colors. They also have different growth structures. Some are more mushy looking, kind of like mashed potatoes. Other ones have very crystalline structures. Let's see. Seeing if we can find a good one. Okay, if you can see that one, it has a more crystalline structure, where this one over here is more mushy. And the different regions demonstrate the different areas where I took the samples from, you can actually tell that they're more pink ones. I'm not quite sure which specific halophile that is, but there's more pink from a certain area. One area specifically grew very crystalline structures compared to the softer ones. So you can see that there are specific halophiles in the different regions we collected samples from.
Do you collect them from the desert varnish or just from any kind of soil?
Well, the desert varnish, I did a couple of soil samples, gypsum, and about one quart sample that I did find. So about four or five different places that I found them. I'm doing a baseline survey to find the areas where we can actually find them here. There'll be another crew coming in after me that are going to dig deeper, working with my baseline, see where else they can specifically find them as well.
Well, let's see. A normal, I mean, it really, I mean, I think we were kind of dropping into a very useful comm lingo. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, you always start out real strict because you got to figure out who's out there. You got to remember who's Alpha, who's Bravo, who's mm-hmm. Commander. You know,
that's kinda, why we need nifty call signs.
Big Daddy.
Which is true. And actually, when we were riding, I said something to the guys in the airlock. You know, it's actually a bad idea to arbitrarily call people Alpha and Bravo, because then everybody will be Alpha and Bravo at different times, and it's no, you don't know who's who.
I like him as Geo Man. It's Marvin, and you're Big Daddy. He's Mother Hen.
Mother Hen. Got Mountain Goat.
Mountain Goat?
Mountain Goat. Geoman, Marvin. Oh, we need
the only one without a name.
We need to think of a good one now. We need to get her back. We'll
toast.
Toast.
Toast. Yeah, toast.
Toast. I can be toast. I like toast. That's cute.
Silly rabbit.
Because that way, if you call someone by a nifty name, A, you don't forget it, and B, they always know who they are.
Daddy, goat, hen, geo.
Mother hen. I don't think I can be just hen. I have to be mother hen.
And you're Big Daddy.
I'm gonna write up the details. I'm gonna put it in the format of this mission plan, and I'll send it to everybody. And so we all know what we're talking about.
Okay.
All right. Is that it? Is that okay for now?
That sounds perfect.
Now, what we don't have is tomorrow's mission.
I want to go out and collect samples.
Well, no matter what, we know we're going out to get samples. And if nothing else, you know where you're going to go walk, right?
We need to get that rover up and running. I was disappointed in that today.
That could be a good secondary mission. Even if there's a primary team away, we could have a near team.
Yeah, right, yeah. Mm-hmm. We don't need the ATVs for that.
Right.
As long as we have sunlight. Okay, I'll work up an EVA, pre-EVA checklist.
2-3 years ago.
I'll look in the documentation we already have and build from there.
C'est bon?
Yes.
So I'm going to write this up and publish the EVA for tonight's mission, but like Heinrich, we need to think of a fast way to burn through these waypoints and get them on there and get a trip. Okay. And it's not your responsibility solely, but it is your software, and it is beautiful. Yeah.
Picture downloading for today's report.
As an aside, okay, so our after-action review is complete. It's almost, I gotta get my commander's report by 7. Kathy's collecting the science reports. Ben, you got the engineering report by 9. So yeah, we need to have, everyone needs to have the pictures to Heinrich by, let's say, 8 o'clock. So you can push them before 9.
Okay.
Our commander.
My name is John Itema. I'm an engineering manager. I run a plastics factory in France. And I've been slotted as the commander of Crew 42 here at the Mars Desert Research Station. I'm very comfortable in a management-type position. My wife and I were joking that this would be very relaxing for me because I could leave my factory and all my responsibilities behind, come here and be the crew engineer, or maybe take on some mission specialist responsibilities, whatever science task they may be. I can work in a lab. I can do analytical work. These are the things I can do well. And then ultimately, they handed me the commander's job. And I'm glad to do it. I'm not uncomfortable at all in this position, but I was very surprised. The task of the commander is, I think you need to keep your team motivated to continue working towards their objectives and to keep the morale of the team high. You know, what I've seen happen with other small groups of people that work in teams aside, this size, people will get fractured and groups start working on their own little projects, and ultimately, especially with such a high quality group of people such as we have in Crew 42, we have to keep everybody together. Everyone is going to work towards the same objective. We're all going to plan out the day's activities the night before, and the next day we execute them, and in this way we can work through the entire rotation.
You're working in a research station now, but would you work as a real astronaut?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. It's my dream. Since I was a young man, I've had my application in at NASA to be an astronaut. And much like the Mars Society, they have not yet chosen to choose me for any of those duties. Maybe what I need to do is call them and ask them what I need to do to update my resume.
And which job as an astronaut would be your dream job?
My dream job, I don't know. I think just any kind of rudimentary involvement. I would even be happy to be involved on the ground at the engineering level, part of the mission designer, designing the mission rather. But on a crew, I'm a grunt engineer. I'm very trainable. I work in a lab. I would be a mission specialist. I'm not a pilot, but I do have outdoor and survival skills, and I think maybe we'll need those kinds of people that are both technical and also survivalists on the moon and Mars. I think I have a skill set that would be useful. I have no delusions that I'll be an astronaut in my lifetime. However, it is a dream of mine.
There was a complete astronomical observatory next to the hab, but when we arrived, it was not operational. Thanks to Ben and Dennis, after a few days' work, we could use it again, and the crew astronomer and crew engineer prepared a live show for us through the telescope, showing Mars, the Pleiades, M42, M31, and Saturn.
Well, let's see. The constellations, the zodiac constellations, are in a poem. The Mercury astronauts had to learn this poem, okay, because they were afraid that if they got in outer space they could get lost. Mm-hmm. So they needed to know this poem so they could learn the constellations in order. So they go like this, starting with Aries, which is right over here. In fact, Mars is in Aries right now. They go like this. The ram, the bull, the heavenly twins, and next the crab, the lion shines. The lion's come up, Leo. There's Leo right down there. Uh-huh. See the question mark? Next the crab, the lion shines, the virgin and the scales, the scorpion, archer, and the goat, the man who holds the watering pot, and fish with glittering tails. And that's like the signs of the zodiac, the 12 signs of the zodiac. They made the astronauts learn that, just in case they get lost. They went to school in North Carolina. The Mercury astronauts went to Chapel Hill, where there's a planetarium. And that's one of the things they made them learn.
Okay.
The ram, it doesn't rhyme. The ram, the bull, the heavenly twins, and next the crab, the lion shins, shines. Pleiades are really seven sisters, so people think that there should be seven, but most people can see six.
Yeah.
But if you get a telescope, you can see lots. There's lots of them there. Not very many stars, and they're not tightly bound gravitationally. They're not like a glob. And a star on the edge will float away, and a star on the other edge will float some other direction. And so clusters eventually dissipate, and not clusters anymore. So the Pleiades is like that. It's an open cluster. The one we're going to now, M42, is in the Sword of Orion, the Orion Nebula. And this is where stars are born. This is a stellar nursery. And we've actually seen stars inside that cloud that are less than a million years old. They've just been born. Less than a million years old. If you see the three stars in the belt of Orion, hanging down from the belt looks sort of like a sword. Sort of. Yeah, yeah, that's. It does look like something else, doesn't it? But there goes your survey. But about the next to the last star in the sword looks a little fuzzy. That's the Orion Nebula. The whole nebula, it's a huge gas cloud. And if you hold your hand out like that, straight in front of you, and you spread your fingers, the whole cloud is bigger than your hand. All the stars that we see there are on this side of the cloud.
Yeah.
And it just so happens that there's some stars being born in there, and they're sort of kicking the blankets off their crib, and we can see inside. Taurus is that V, that between Orion and the Pleiades. It's sort of a V shape with that real bright Aldebaran, the reddish star there. Yeah, that V are the horns of the bull. That's the horns of the bull there.
And that big, swooping.
Yes, that big swooping.
You know, I've never noticed a swoop before.
Now, if you look at the other side of Orion, you might be able to see his club. He's holding a club up on the other side.
Yeah,
in his whip from Beetlejuice, if you go from Beetlejuice up, his right arm, he's sort of holding a club like that.
Yeah. Moving the dome slightly clockwise.
Okay, thanks for the warning.
Okay, over here.
Watch your head. He says after she bangs it.
Oh my
gosh, are you serious?
Listen to this.
Thank you.
I love it. That's
You're
the great. That's the greatest sound ever, isn't it, Ben?
Yes, that's why you do outreach.
That's a cardboard cutout. Give me a break.
That's beautiful.
For real.
That's for real.
That's beautiful.
That's how it looked about 3 hours ago.
That is a cardboard cutout. My God.
When Galileo pointed his telescope at Saturn and stuff, a lot of people said the same thing she said. You painted on the inside of the tube. You painted that.
You know how
can't
you
really
like
be
those
that.
Cardboard cutouts and
can't
shine
really be
light
that. It's
from
too
behind
pretty.
It?
Huh.
That's what this looks like. Good
and of
Lord.
Course they put him on trial.
It looks fake, doesn't it?
The other thing is funny is
I would never believe that. I mean, I've seen pictures and I know that's what it's supposed to look like, but
a little bit of the shadow of the ring.
My name is Dennis Hands, and I'm a retired school teacher, taught high school social studies for 30 years, and I'm retired right now, so I'm working part-time at a natural science center here at Mars Desert Research Station. My official job is crew astronomer, and I'm helping Ben, our chief engineer, get the telescope and the observatory up and running. Before I got here, I was hoping to do some variable star research to look at some variable stars and see how they're changing over time. But then a couple days before departing for MDRS, I got news that the observatory was not working. So I left all my variable star stuff at home and came to just help get the observatory up and running. And now the observatory is up and running. All my stuff is at home. When it comes to looking at planets, I tend to think that Mars is one of the more boring planets to look at. Jupiter, Saturn, some of those planets are a lot prettier, a lot more interesting to look at. But Mars is boring to look at through a telescope. It's just a butterscotch orange circle. If I were on Mars, I think I'd be more interested in looking down at the planet than looking up at the sky. If I were really on Mars, I think that most of the sky would look pretty much the same from Mars as it does from Earth. You might get a little better view because of the thinner atmosphere, but I'd be more interested in looking down and seeing if there's life.
From Mars, we could most probably find the blue Earth and the moon in the telescope. Moons of Mars move too fast for a telescope, but with the naked eye, they would be observable, such as we observed the International Space Station crossing the sky on one evening.
Space Station is passing over. Space Station is passing over. We got Space Station!
2 weeks passed too fast, and we had to break sim and return to real world.
You just...
Break sim! Alright.
Are we ever going to meet again? Who knows? But even if we could not travel to Mars, as no one can now, our crew could at least simulate the life and work of the future Marsonauts. NASA plans to reallocate its human spaceflight budget for the building of a lunar base. If this huge mission is successful, the next phase would be Mars. Today, we cannot go to Mars. We don't have the rockets, the technology, a spaceship. We have almost nothing for a human spaceflight to Mars. What we have are smaller rovers on Mars and larger ones in the planning phase, which would explore the red planet. If a human base is built either on Mars or the Moon, it will have to use local or in-situ resources. Only minimal cargo could be transferred from the Earth. But this is science fiction today. Even NASA cannot look this far. Maybe not in our lifetime. Maybe not in our century. But we do hope that humans will land on Mars. We would go to Mars to make a second living planet in the solar system, to plant the seeds of life, for terraforming Mars and start up a second experiment of evolution. A living world independent from the Earth. It is of course a question whether Mars can sustain life on its surface. It is also a question whether there is already native life on Mars. If there is, do we have the right to take our DNA-based life and maybe destroy true Martian life? Questions without answers.
But the answers are there, on Mars. That's why we have to go there. On to Mars.